people had said, I'm out of approved therapies. I need something, or I'm on my last approved therapy and I'm not sure it's working. So I want to already see what's coming next. And one person even put, thank you so much. We never had access to this information.
Hi, I'm Alex, and welcome to the X-Health Show, where I talk to visionaries behind the latest innovations in healthcare for the extra health of the future. From the 15th floor where we're recording, Zurich looks like a lively toy city, and on a sunny day such as today, the Alps emerge on the horizon. Danielle Ralic is the CEO of Ancora AI. She's a technologist that used to develop analytics solutions for pharmaceutical and healthcare organizations. Now she's on a mission to bring treatments available in breakthrough clinical studies to cancer patients. Ancora AI is a Swiss startup that developed an AI-powered platform where cancer patients and their loved ones can search for available trials in a matter of minutes. You'll hear about why to consider a clinical trial if you're a cancer patient, how to find a relevant trial, why it is so frustrating for both those who run them and patients, and how tech paired with willing humans can help. Danielle, what was the moment that you decided to drop your consultancy job and build a solution for cancer patients searching for the last, well, the last hope clinical trial treatment?
Yeah, thanks. It was a series of events, but it all started with I studied information systems with a specialty in healthcare IT because I really saw the potential of technology in healthcare to make people's lives better. And I really think healthcare is one of the most noble industries anyone can work in. And so I spent my career trying to find where is this innovation? Where are we doing technology or implementing technology that helps people and really all people? I'm a big proponent of equity as well when we build these solutions, and was fortunate enough to work in several cities with multiple, big healthcare institutions, kind of learning what technology and healthcare is like and implementing solutions in these settings. But I was just frustrated with the pace. And I was lucky enough to be working and supporting pharmaceutical clients. And so I had a front row seat to all the innovation that was happening, and specifically oncology or cancer. And I was seeing all of these amazing things they were studying, putting in trials. And then I also had a front row seat to reality for many patients, including my family and friends, and seeing their experiences in healthcare. And it was seeing friends getting diagnosed with cancer.
Oh,
and
I'm so sorry to hear that.
I think we all have, unfortunately, these stories. But seeing that and not seeing them not being offered trials, and then knowing that trials offer this potential in terms of it could help you be better diagnosed, it could help extend your life, it could even cure your cancer. So it's, to me, it's a really important option that everyone should be presented. And I kept kind of bumping into this personally, I guess, this problem of it's not happening as often as it should be. And it all, I guess, peaked when I was, from the pharma side or professionally seeing the challenge they had of recruiting patients, and then personally seeing the lack of outreach or kind of options for people that I knew.
So, I mean, the issues on both sides, really, so like the pharma cannot recruit enough patients and patients can't find trials.
Exactly.
Awesome.
Exactly. Yeah. Not good. And, it all peaked when I was hiking and, happened to bump into a man who asked me to take a photo of him and his wife.
Where was it?
This was in Patagonia.
So, awesome. Okay.
So quite, remote. And we just kind of got to talking, and he was asking what I was doing. And at the time I was working on analyzing enrollment of a PD-L1 inhibitor. And so I just kind of mentioned that checkpoint inhibitors, and he had stopped me and said, "Girl, you're speaking my language." And I was like, "I'm sorry." He's like, "Oh, are you an oncologist or a researcher?" He's like, "Oh, no. I'm just a cancer patient." And I was like, "Wow, well, that's really amazing that you know about this." I mean, this was just in trials at the time. And he said, "Yeah, I'm really fortunate. I had stage 4 cancer. So far, it's holding. I'm out here hiking with my wife because we're going to enjoy this as long as we can. And I'm here because my wife's friends, neighbors, cousin, aunt, that kind of story, happened to be working at MD Anderson and heard of a trial. And just because of that, he had access to a clinical trial that extended his life, saved his life. And it was really one of those moments where you see the theoretical science and trials that you've talked about at work meet the person or the real life side. And you really see and feel that impact. And you think, gosh, shouldn't everybody have this chance? And that's why I started Ancora. And also Ancora itself, or Ancora, means again, or a new hope. And I really think trials do represent that. And again, that's why everyone should have this option.
How high was that?
It was a really hard hike, actually. I remember thinking, like, oh my gosh, yeah, you should be the poster child for this therapy, because I mean, I'm okay in shape, but it was a pretty high hike. And I don't know, I think it took us 4 hours to get up there. So very impressive man.
Okay. So, I mean, he was like cleared at the time, basically, yeah. Thanks to the therapy that he got, because someone knew someone who knew someone. And that's...
Shouldn't be happening in this year.
Is how it really happens, isn't it? Like, how do people get to know about trials, really?
No, that's exactly right. From the patient side, it's through a set of connections, asking friends and family, asking patient support groups, happening upon maybe a trial being marketed somewhere if you're in the US. And then for physicians, it's what did they remember at a conference, or do they remember trials at their institution? Or they'll call a colleague and ask them if they happen to know. But if you're hearing the words I'm saying, it's not a very systematic process or data-driven process. And that's what, you know, with a background in tech, this is why I really think tech flourishes. Tech is amazing in curating information and helping kind of dissect a lot of data. And so this is a perfect use case. And I would hope that healthcare would be data-driven, systematic. And again, if we can do that, we'll have less of these stories of kind of sheer luck or coincidence. And I always say, you know, if you think about it, then you're leaving your kind of best chance at life up to luck. And it's 2023. We have amazing technology. There's no excuses for not using technology in this case.
Yeah, totally. And especially that, I mean, search tools, we use it like on a daily basis. Like, I mean, we can't probably even count like how many times a day we use them, right?
Yeah.
Why can't we have them for the clinical trials, really, you know? So I read this blog post, like really detailed blog post of Beth Steelman wrote. She's a medical doctor, and she was looking for a trial for her husband. Like, suddenly after surgery, you know, he developed 8 new tumors within a month. And that basically triggered her to like accelerate the search for a clinical trial. You know, so she published basically at some point in this post what she does if she wants a certain dress, right? She went to H&M website. And, you know, like the long story short, you know, she had a couple of dresses, you know, chosen for her based on what she put into this search tool. And she was like, oh my God, let the clinicaltrials.gov, you know, hire their website developer, you know?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't work this way when you go and look for the trial. But we'll come back to that. First, let's maybe go one step back. And we know... We already spoke a bit about like why to choose a trial, because it can be basically life-saving, right? But it's not like it's a trial, but we have like 3 phases and some sub-phases probably. Could you speak a bit more about that? So what's there and what are the differences between the phases?
Yeah, the phases of trials are essentially kind of the steps to getting it approved for the wider population. And so they evaluate them in these steps, and the first is starting with safety. So just, can we put this, it's kind of first in human. So it's going from the labs to people. It's usually a smaller population. And there it's really just to see in people, is this tolerable and is this safe? And kind of as the phases increase, there's more and more people being invited to the study, because we're trying to make sure the drugs or the new therapies work on different types of people. That's a recent push, thank God, from a lot of the regulatory bodies.
So women actually can have a drug that was actually, you know, checked on other women.
Yes, because in fact, we are different, which took them a little too long to realize, but that's okay.
So I was watching your YouTube channel, and there was this host, Megan Claire Chase, breast cancer survivor. that she basically, it took her a couple of years to be diagnosed because she experienced different symptoms that a white woman would. So, I mean...
Yeah, no, exactly that. And a lot of the studies are heavily biased towards white men even. There's actually some phenomenal oncologists in Europe trying to research this. And some of the indicators are actually male oncologists suggest trials to men, but not as often to women.
Oh, wow.
And there's a lot of bias, and this kind of goes back to if the process is based on what you remember, who you know, and things like that, we really introduce a lot of opportunity for bias to hinder who's even invited to these studies. And I think the representation on the trials is critical because you want to make sure it's safe for everyone and that it works as well for
and
everyone.
The dose is, and the dose is appropriate.
right, which is one of the famous ones for Zoloft, where women, after 2 decades of getting into car accidents, because they wake up in the morning still groggy, realize that women metabolize drugs differently in this particular one, and that women actually should receive half the dose. But that's why now there is a big push for diversity on trials. It's taken a little too long to happen, but let's just say we'll celebrate the fact that it's happening. And it's for all those things mentioned, you know, that Black women can present differently with symptoms. Our bodies might metabolize things differently as well. So it's really, really important that we have these populations to be able to study it. And before, it was just white men were the least risk to your study as well, because women were complicated, so you have hormones and all these things. So you don't want to complicate your study, which might risk the results and might risk your new therapy. Thankfully, we've learned that it has a lot of, let's say, late stage effects in terms of could be harmful effects on these different populations that weren't studied. And a lot of drugs were pulled from the market because of that. So thankfully, we have this awareness now and a big push from, again, regulatory bodies saying we really need to do better and we have to invite these populations to studies.
Right. So we have 3 phases. What are the differences for the clinical trials?
Yeah, so there's 4 phases, actually. And then the first one is that it's just that safety, a small population. The second is evaluating efficacy, so how well is it working? And then we really look at phase 3 for that. Is it working better than the standard of care? And this is where it's great if you have a therapy that works, but it has to work better than what we have, because obviously you want people to use it and for all the right reasons. And so there you'll have the comparator. I think another important thing to note, though, with these studies is that with cancer, I think a lot of the fears we heard from patients were that I don't want to be on a trial where there's a placebo, yeah, because if you have cancer, of course,
you
not
don't
getting,
have time to yeah. like take yeah. water with sugar.
right. And thankfully, there is a lot of safety involved in trials and how we set them up and what kind of patients are invited in populations. And one of the big things there is no placebo for oncology. So if it's someone, it's unethical to do that. And so I think that's another thing just to stress for anyone listening, because I know that's been brought up many times. And they'll always be looking at either the standard of care to compare with the current drug, or in the earlier phases, it may just be the drug itself, the investigational treatment.
We'll be right back. This episode is brought to you by The X-Health Show and me, Alex. If you still haven't, please hit follow at the top. That'll help me bring more of these visionaries to you. Thanks a lot. Stay awesome now. Back to the episode. So we have this database, the US database, that actually the whole world is using, right? So, I mean, Professor George Kukos that I interviewed before, you know, he says like everyone who has a clinical trial registers the trial in this US database, or they should, or they do it because they want to. And this is clinicaltrials.gov, but it has many flaws, doesn't it? Right.
Yes.
So I coming back to this blog post I mentioned, Bess Stillman, you know, so she basically starts, it's like a series of 3 very long posts. She started as, my husband Jake is dying of recurrent metastatic squamous cell carcinoma, RMHNSCC, and he's exhausted conventional treatments, so his only chance at survival is a miracle clinical trial drug, right? And then she basically describes her way how to find the clinical study that would work for him. And this is actually, you know, there's so many, it's so difficult because it's not like you Google it. So she gives this example, like, if you change the wording of the search, even subtly, you know, you'll get totally different outcomes. She also, I mean, so she's a medical doctor, so she also has an access to doctor groups. And she asked several doctors, or some, you know, doctors offered her help, and like five doctors delivered completely different five trials. They were not matching, you know, they were all got the same history, the patient's history, right? So she, let me give you an example, for example. So she could search for squamous cell carcinoma of the head and neck. The different results were for head and neck squamous cell carcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma of the tongue, tongue squamous cell cancer. I mean, we can see there are similar keywords, right? And then they don't, yeah. Let me just, you know, shorten a bit this story, because I mean, what worked for her, she basically found someone suggested there is a person that actually does this search professionally. And that person spent 15 hours on searching for the trials, you know, the way she basically figured out the system. Plus, there was also another thing. So her husband actually read about a trial that completely doesn't mention his cancer type. And actually, this could also work. And in this database, they would not find it. So, I mean, this is, yeah, that there are a lot of problems in that, right? So how did you basically approach them when you wanted to found a startup, you know?
Yeah, so I think one important thing, especially in tech, or what I believe is to understand the data, you have to understand the system. So why was it built? How was it built? And who's putting data in? And to understand clinicaltrials.gov, its real intention or purpose is to be a registry. So a place to list these trials. As you mentioned, it's a popular database, mostly because you want to list your trials and conduct trials in the US to get FDA approval. And that's because your highest price for a drug will likely be in the US. And so there is a lot of incentive to run these trials and have them in the US and in this registry. I will note there are exceptions. So in Europe, the work we do, we actually have to bring in some local trials. And so we work with organizations like SAKK here in Switzerland who help kind of augment that data for us. And then, of course, in Asia, I think the WHO database is a bit stronger. And so they're all just places to list this. So there's no real motivation to keep this data incredibly tidy. It's just a place to put things. And so that's why you see a lot of variation in terms of even within one cancer, how you talk about it. And I think the other part that adds the complexity is clinical research is the bleeding edge of medicine. It's what we're just finding out, we're learning together, and it's accelerated so much because of the data we have, the technology we have. And that acceleration, while it's fantastic, it also means the way we talk about things, the way we understand things is also accelerating. And so if you think of learning concepts, we start talking about these concepts differently very quickly. And so that's what makes it really difficult to have these kind of standards in terms of how we're talking about it. And maybe one example, we're working now on nuclear medicine, which can be known as radioligand therapy, radiotheranostics, and there's, I think, seven other different names or categories for this. So if you think of searching through the data, I mean, that really blows up trying to find what you're looking for. It makes it so much harder. And so I think that's the important context to understanding what you're getting. And when we first started, actually, someone told me it wouldn't be possible to use natural language processing on this data for these reasons of complexity of the jargon. It's also unstructured and shorthand. So for natural language processing, like, punctuation is very important because it helps us understand how we found the text and what the relationship is to other text. But when it's just bullet points or just sentences combined, and then again, it's just a registry, so no one is looking at making sure the formatting is nice, you can really see anything and everything. And the point you mentioned about kind of looking for a specific condition is a really interesting one because of, again, how research has evolved. And one of the interesting things is in oncology or cancer, we're moving towards precision medicine, where the specific type of cancer isn't the most important criteria anymore. And so to that woman's point, You can be looking for solid tumor trials, which just mean it has to be a solid tumor, not a blood cancer. And it has to have a certain type of molecular profile or certain mutations and certain prior therapies. And so now if you're looking for specifically in clinicaltrials.gov for head and neck, will it pick up all of the solid tumor trials?
Exactly.
I have found not much.
This is exactly like, you know, some of the, you know, top search results, they actually had this solid tumor or like a specific gene modification.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly, exactly. And then so from our side, we started with just saying, let's approach it as we can't trust anything we see. So even the underlying ontology, they can also mark up what they think the trial is related to. So kind of these meta terms. And we try to use all of them, but we had to put our own weighted ranking system for kind of this logical check at the end, because we have this kind of zero trust approach to it. And we built our own ontology. So we sat down and said, okay, based on how patients are treated, how do we organize cancer? And we started with that split, solid tumors and blood. Like that's usually a pretty big wall. And then from there, kind of organizing the data. And then we use that ontology to take in everything from clinicaltrials.gov and map it to our ontology to be able to overcome some of the solid tumor pieces, neuroendocrine tumors, because of the ontology used in clinicaltrials.gov erroneously brings up melanoma trials, sarcoma trials. So in that example, we bring in over 700 trials. And then with our mapping, we're able to find the actual 155 trials that are actually an option for neuroendocrine tumor patients. So there's a lot of work just in first that mapping at a condition level, what really belongs to these diseases, what are real options. And then from there, you begin the eligibility criteria, and then there's quite a bit more work.
How do you do this mapping? I can assume that it's actually a real person that does it, or how? Yeah.
Yeah, the first ontology was with our team. And whenever we add a new cancer, we like to do it with a scientific expert group. So we're a small team. We can't be experts in every cancer. But this is where there's a lot of smart people out there. And so when we sat down, neuroendocrine tumors was one of the most recent ones. We had an amazing patient advocate, Josh Mailman, who brought in this amazing expert panel. So we had Thor from Mayo Clinic. We had a representative from Stanford, NIH, Dr. Heidi Rivera. So a lot of people who've spent their careers in neuroendocrine tumors who helped us say, this is how I think about this disease. This is what's relevant and this is what isn't. So we can kind of borrow their knowledge to build that ontology. And then once we have it built, then of course we automate the extraction and the mapping of it. But it is something that has to be revisited all the time just because clinical research is advancing so fast, which is great because we do need these advancements. But it's not a one and done job.
Let me maybe just say about, you know, because I tried your platform. It's already live, right? So patients can already go there and try it. And I'll ask some questions on the way because you already like started, you know, answering some of them. Yeah. So the first step, you basically select the condition, right? And there are 17 options of cancer. And why these 17?
We started with four. And because we add one condition at a time, it's really based on either the data that we have what we're seeing patients looking for. And we've had requests come through our inbox. Can you add this kind of cancer? So it's been a little bit on patient need, but also the patient groups and the scientific experts that we have access to. So for neuroendocrine tumors, I mentioned that group. With leukemias, it was the Allen team. So when we have that support, then we'll add that type of cancer. So we did begin with the big ones, but I think there's a even bigger need for some of these smaller cancer types that maybe other more commercially driven companies go for the big ones first. Of course, you have the quote bigger market, but I think the need is even greater in some of these other cancers.
And basically what I'm hearing you saying is it is an AI platform, but to make it happen, you basically need a lot of humans at the very beginning.
Yeah. And part of it was that it's health and we wanted to make sure we were getting it right. So what I thought in the beginning was if we have a bit more manual intervention to set this up, I think that's good. I think we learn from it and then we learn how to better encode it when we better understand the data and what we're doing for it in terms of the transformations. And then we use our AI part as natural language processing for the eligibility criteria. So we don't use it to suggest trials. And that's a really important statement because one, if someone uses AI to suggest a trial, I would be very cautious of what it's suggesting. So if we're using historical data to train these models, we just talked about women only recently being invited to studies. So you can imagine who it would suggest trials for and those sorts of things. So I think we have to be a bit more guarded about how we build it. But there has been a lot of wonderful advancements, especially with LLMs, access to GPUs that I think now what I'd like to see for us is to advance our AI even further, but still just on the extraction and the processing of the clinical trial information, not per se the matching, because I think that still needs to be a bit based on the really criteria driven versus us trying to suggest something at this point. I don't know. And if someone is listening and has ideas, please contact me.
Okay. So at first, there are 17 options of cancer types to choose from and the location. So I've chosen ovarian cancer and Basel. That's where I'm based. Then, you know, there are some specifying questions. So like what type of ovarian cancer? There are six options, plus also an option I don't know. If, well, someone doesn't know, then low grade or high grade, plus again, the option I'm not sure. Then which stage? Then do you have any metastasis in your brain? Now, this is when I started thinking, like, why did you ask this question? Is it like a question you ask with all cancers? Yeah.
Some. Yeah. So our process for each condition is to look at what questions can we ask that we hope people could answer. But the second piece is that impacts what trials we show. And the perspective of the technology is more the process of elimination. So as you answer questions and we understand the diagnosis a bit better, what prior therapies there are, we remove trials that have said basically you've met an exclusion criteria. And the reason for brain metastases, and it's a bit of a historical one, and I think it's evolving and we'll have to see how it changes. But historically, brain mets are very difficult. There's the blood-brain barrier. It's very difficult to penetrate. People usually don't have good outcomes when they have metastases in the brain. And so it was kind of a standard exclusion criteria for a lot of studies. It is changing now. Some of the shift is, if you have brain metastases, is it controlled or not? So that's something that we've put in the platform. But there is a lot of discussion about, can we allow these patients to participate because they are the ones that have some of the highest needs for these therapies? And so it's a bit of a historical exclusion criteria. But the questions that we're asking are because we found them in trials and they're noted as exclusion or they're noted as inclusion. And because if we know what they're requiring for participation, we can inherit what that exclusion criteria is. So if they're requiring a small cell diagnosis, small cell lung cancer, and you've reported that you have non-small cell, then we know we can kind of inherit that this is not a trial for you because mm-hmm. they're looking for the opposite subtype.
All right. Then the question is, has your cancer tested positive for any of the below genetic mutations, otherwise known as tumor markers? And this is BRCA1, BRCA2, HRD. Then there's question about treatments received, and it is a yes or no question. So chemotherapy, surgery, radiotherapy, hormonal treatment, PARP inhibitor, then antiangiogenesis inhibitor. And then there are a couple of questions about year of birth, menopausal status, and, any other diseases or medical conditions. Or like, you know, the physical ability, basically. So based on these questions, 8 results popped up. And there was yet another question, like, are you looking to participate in a trial in the next 6 months? And, the reason to do the search, I guess that is for you, for Ancora and I, right, to basically know what people are looking there and the preferred language. Now, so the search distance was automatically set, I think, to 100 kilometers. And the highest score for there was a trial at the University of Basel, so basically the same city. The score was 70%. What does it mean?
Yes. So the matching score, again, this is not the part related to AI, but as you're giving information about the type of cancer, the type of prior therapies you may have had, the other maybe medical conditions you may have, basically we assign points to how it fits what the trial is looking for. So for ovarian, if you have a subtype that that trial is looking for or has mentioned in the inclusion criteria, you get a set of points. If you have, if you've mentioned you have a mutation and that's mentioned in the inclusion criteria, another point. And so it's, we're not trying to say this is the trial for you. I think that's very difficult to say, and every patient has a different situation and what they're looking for as well. So it's very difficult to suggest trials, but we wanted a way to just at least put at the top the trials that really matched the situation that we've learned from the questionnaire that you've provided.
Yeah, and let's just say that clinicaltrials.gov, they don't do that. So they show you the most relevant trials to whatever, you know, keywords you're searching for.
Right. And it's, yeah, you'd have to put a lot of keywords to try to get the information that we're collecting. Mm-hmm. And I think the questionnaire is just, and, you know, why we built the questionnaire is there's certain things that if we know this, we can just help reduce the number just to help you have a smaller set that then you can go into details with, and either yourself or taking it to a physician. But the questionnaire was to collect that information to do this more specific matching. And then because it's online, you can take your time. It doesn't time out. So if you need to reference records, hopefully you can do that. And we do try to collect data to see how usable is it. Do we see people answering the questions? How long does it take? And I think the good thing is we've seen people answer most questions, even those at the end. And also it takes around 5 minutes to use the tool, which to your 15-hour point is it's a big improvement.
Yeah. And then, you know, I just widened the search. I wanted to see, you know, like globally, how many results were there? And there was like over 1,000. But then again, you know, there were just a few 70% match and a couple in the US and one in China, which is like pretty far. But I mean, still, is this 70% something like you could go and try and check what's there? Because also what stopped me was that this particular clinical trial mentioned in Basel, you know, the start date was 2020. And I started wondering, like, do they still recruit, even though it says they still are recruiting?
Yes, this is our fun as well. Back to clinicaltrials.gov being a registry, there's no need or push for maintaining this data in a real-time way. And recruitment can fluctuate quite quickly, especially for early phase trials where maybe you only have 12 slots on this trial and it can quickly fill up, or someone can drop and then one slot become available. And so because it's not a requirement to maintain this data on clinicaltrials.gov, it is not. And we've had some of these scenarios, and we end up calling the pharma company or the site that's running it. And we ask them if it's still recruiting, and when they tell us, "Oh no, it's been closed for a few months," we update it on our platform, so we'll not show it anymore. So our platform only shows trials that are recruiting or soon to be recruiting, and so we would hide it from there. But it is one of our greatest challenges and call to action. If anyone listening is pharma or hospitals, please work with us. This data is so important, and we've actually introduced this validated flag on the cards for pharma companies that work with us or hospitals that work with us and choose to share the information with us on a monthly basis to say, yes, at each of these 5 or 10 hospitals that my trial is at, I can confirm that these 7 are open, but these 3 are closed. And so we put the validated flag, and within that matching score, so I always say, let science win. So it's always within the matching score range. So in the 70%, if one of those has been validated, we put those first because we have, in a way, confirmed that this is really an option. And I'm hoping we can get many more validated flags, but we certainly need the cooperation of pharma companies and hospitals to do so.
Okay, so let me put it straight. Like, this 70% match, is it a fail, or is it like what could I do with that information really?
Yeah, so because it's process of elimination, anything being shown on the results page is a potential for you. So it's not that, you know, 70 is bad. It just means you've hit more of these points. So your profile matches what they're looking for, which may mean that it's a more interesting trial for you. But at the same time, there's a lot of trials for support around cancer care. So example might be meditation exercises as you're going through therapy, because they know anxiety actually has negative consequences on how well you respond to different therapies. So that usually doesn't have very strict inclusion-exclusion criteria. It's just, let's say, a breast cancer diagnosis and you're about to start treatment. So it would have a low score on our platform. So it wouldn't come up high because it wouldn't match subtypes or mutations or prior therapies. But it could be a really interesting option. And so it's based on what you're looking for. Again, we're just hoping it's some sort of indicator for if you're looking for something, it's a therapeutic, that hopefully these scores will help you at least organize your search and starting from maybe the top of the searches down. But by no means does it mean that it's bad. It's just how many criteria you've hit that are matching that trial.
Okay, so as far as I understand, this is where Ancora AI's role is ending, right? So, I mean, now it's my decision or my oncologist, if I want to share the results with him or her, to decide whom to call or whom to write an email? Like, what do you do then?
We'll be right back. I want to say thank you for listening to this episode. If you find it interesting and feel particularly generous today, leave a review, hit this star rating. I'll be able to continue with the X-Health show for you. 3, 2, 1, and back to the episode.
Well, originally... Yes, we thought this was, I built the tool that I would have wanted when my friends were being diagnosed. So I built the tool to help me go through the information. But then I realized it stops short because, yes, to really have an impact, you need to go that next step because it's not enough to just find this. You need to get connected. So I like to talk about it as discover, decide, and connect. And so discover is that initial just what's out there. Decide is maybe using the matching score, maybe some of our filters. So you're looking for checkpoint inhibitor trials or certain mutation trials. So that's kind of the decide. And then connect is where on the platform, if there's a trial of interest, you can click put me in contact. And this is the point where we would ask for you to register because we'll need your consent and information. But then we start to look at that trial for you. So we'll see with what information you provided, is that a good fit? So does it hit the criteria? And as long as nothing excludes you, then we pass it on. And then we call the pharma or the hospital to see, again, first, is it still recruiting? Are there slots available? And two, we summarize the profile, the diagnosis and the therapies. We say, you know, is this patient look okay from your perspective? And can we refer them over? That's where we have a lot of fun. And there's not a lot of processes in place today for this kind of connection pathway. And what I've observed or reflected, and I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I think the decades-old way of recruitment was going to 5 hospitals and those doctors and saying, how many patients do you have for this breast cancer study? And then you would call up that physician and try to find those 10 patients. So it's very much dependent on a hospital and dependent on doctors. And this, in a way, is kind of shifting the narrative to direct to patient. So kind of power of consumerism in a way. But who's incredibly motivated? It's the person who's sick and their family. And so this direct to patient is a new way of thinking about trials and recruitment. And a lot of the reasons why we didn't even have this option before was because it was so incredibly challenging to even find a trial on your own. So it would have been a miracle to go through clinicaltrials.gov, find this trial, and come over. And so this is where we're trying to challenge, again, pharma and hospitals to work differently and work with us to make this connection process smoother, because a lot of pharma and even hospitals have these generic trial email addresses. So trials@pharmacompany.com, and they go unanswered. So it will take a month or 2 months for someone to respond to us, or we've received automatic replies from top 10 pharma. No, we cannot help you. We only talk to patients directly. And if you're one of 5 options for a patient, you've come out of chemo and surgery, are you going to be making phone calls for each of those? I mean, this is what I tried to explain to them. So the process is really, really challenging. And sometimes we've gone through MedInfo of these pharma companies. just to get wrong information. And so there's still a lot of challenges in what I call this last mile of once we found something, how do we get you over to that trial as fast as possible? And in a perfect world, if you had the right information on the other side, I mean, this could be done in less than 2 business days. Check the profile and just a forward over. And so this is the part we're really trying to stand up now. So also, call to action, pharma listening, please work with us because this is possible. And waiting a few months for, you know, metastatic cancer patients who are interested and motivated to join your trial is really unacceptable.
No, it's not. But let me understand that. So, I mean, you have the patient's consent, right? And so you have a team that actually make these phone calls, which is, wow, because this is like the part two of Beth Thielman's blog post, which she calls, again, if this first part was frustrating and like you couldn't get anywhere, the second part actually of getting, you know, someone on the phone or, you know, receiving a reply to an email is, as you describe, it is so frustrating because you don't have time, basically, you know. And then, you know, some require like an in-person visit before even looking at documents, which can be, I mean, so she was considering only the US. I mean, it's, you know, huge enough country, right? But there were like a lot of issues in, you know, just yeah, you know, so she basically was saying about if, you know, she got to someone who's like the main person managing the trial, you know, that was the best because then, you know, she got some understanding. And also, like, you know, quicker, you know, the decision could be made quicker. So it's not, again, like a structured process. It's a bit of luck. It's a bit of someone's willingness, which, I mean, it's so much shouldn't be this way, yes. Right?
And so, the worst part is knowing that where 80% of clinical trials are delayed due to recruitment challenges. So think of the process. We have to go through these phases just to get these drugs approved, to be able to get them on the market for more people to access them. We're delayed in just step one, which is even finding these patients for these trials, which of course has these downstream impacts. I mean, also to cost. So if we could accelerate that, I mean, my gosh, we could bring these amazing new therapies to market faster, help more people get on these trials. And so you see the problem of, oh, we can't find the patients, but at the same time, patients knocking on the doors and we're helping them knock on the doors and no one's answering. So yeah. There's a big mismatch in between. And I think a couple of the things there's a lot of agencies in between as well. And I think the message is getting lost in between. And so I've been trying to raise much more awareness about this process. I try to tell pharma, your doors are closed. They are on fire. They are bolted shut. It takes just absolute magic to be able to get to the other side. And once you do get to the hospitals and the PIs there, then it's been really fast. They'll review, they'll let you know what, no, I think I'd tell them, try one more therapy before you come here. And so they're quite quick to respond, but getting there is very, very challenging. And then a lot of hospitals ask for that first visit because you can charge a first visit. And so the incentives of the healthcare system are another very big challenge for changing how we can do clinical trials to make this a much better, faster, efficient process.
Right. So that's the human factor. Let me ask also on this, you know, I don't know what you use, machine learning, AI, or like whatever you call it, you tell me. How much can you rely on it as a go-to find the trial tool?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely not perfect. But we didn't, I think if we try to go for perfect, we would have still been working on it. And we don't have big fancy investment of 100 million to go build really advanced models. So we had to be much more practical about how we built it. And so we built it with the 80-20 rule. So when we test, is 80% of the data coming through correct? And because it's unstructured text, that's been sometimes copy pasted, sometimes right, sometimes wrong. The text is really difficult to work with. And so we design it, we check it. So 80%, if it passes that test, then we let it be used in the platform. It's not, like I said, it's not perfect, is why we also don't say this is the trial we suggest for you. This is just what we were able to find. And we also have checks on our place of when we do entity recognition. If we find a criteria, we have a confidence score that we assign as well. So we try to put checks in on our place. But if we're not confident enough, we err on the side of showing more rather than less. So if we say, you know what, we're not sure that this is the exact mutation, or they've mentioned this mutation three times in inclusion and exclusion, it seems to be scenario-based, ignore. And so that's how the tech works today. Again, I hope with investment and with some time, we can take advantage of some of the LLMs now and the GPUs that are more available and really enhance the work that we do. But I'd say the perspective so far has been just how do we practically move it forward, and anything we can do to help make this information more accessible to patients is good, and we can do better, but we need just starting with something so people have a tool in their hands and can start to look for this information was kind of the most important criteria for us.
Okay, so whom would you recommend, you know, the platform to use?
Oh, yeah, really, unfortunately, everyone. One of the pieces that we're also reflecting on was who are our ideal users? And you'd really wish that the users would just be oncologists and nurse navigators and the healthcare system itself. But our healthcare system, I mean, we have staff shortages, not enough resources, not enough time. And so it's difficult to just give them more jobs in a way and more tools to do that. So the users that we have are patients and their families. And so people that have been diagnosed either recently or maybe years back, and their loved ones. So we have a lot of daughters, sons, wives, husbands, you name it. And with that, one of the things I strongly encourage is that anyone facing cancer, either themselves or family and friends, to use the tool just to see what's out there. And I really think information is power. As I mentioned, it takes 5 minutes, so it's not a huge time investment, but there's so much going on. And it's difficult for healthcare teams to stay on top of these advances. So it doesn't hurt. It's a 5 minute investment for yourself or your loved one. And just because you weren't offered a trial doesn't mean it's not an option. And I think that's something people have asked us as well. And as I've just said, you know, maybe your physician didn't have time or they didn't think of a trial, but it's worth it to invest this 5 minutes and just see, is there something I should be bringing to my doctor? Is there something I should be looking into a bit more? And even if you don't need a trial today, just to stay on top of it, because so many new things are coming out. And we've had, you mentioned those fields. Are you here because you're looking to join a trial in the next 6 months? And what's the reason of your search today? And we included those because actually physicians didn't believe that patients would do this.
Oh, so you... Oh
so they God. Told us patients wouldn't be able to answer the questions. And pharma told us this as well. And patients aren't, they don't want to join trials. There's no motivation to do that. And so we included those two fields because I had a feeling that that's not right. And again, I'm summarizing here, and there are many exceptions.
So what are the replies that you get?
They absolutely demonstrate that people are here intentionally and want trials and know about them. So we actually have an impact report, and certainly invite it on our website to download, where we did some analysis of these fields. And so the first one, are you looking to join a trial in the next 6 months? 67% of our users said yes, which is amazing. Again, going back to do patients want trials and all those things. And the second question about what's the reason for your search today? If I'm honest, I read through them because I wanted to see for myself what the text was before we did our analysis, and definitely had a good cry after. So I thank everyone who completed those fields, but it was absolutely eye-opening. People had said, I'm out of approved therapies, I need something, or I'm on my last approved therapy and I'm not sure it's working, so I want to already see what's coming next. I want to contribute to research, so I want to see what's out there, how can I help? Other people said, my symptoms are out of control, I'm looking for anything to help lessen the pain. And one person even put, thank you so much, we never had access to this information. So I think those data points were really, really powerful for us to take back to pharma and hospitals. And again, it's not all patients, of course, that want to do this or can do this, but there is a group of people who are looking for this information, are looking to join trials. And I think we have to make this easier for them. And we have to really, I call it kind of unlock access to trials for them. And we need to do that if we're going to fix recruitment, enrollment, and especially if we think of patients as partners, which they are. They can't just be subjects as they used to be. We need to make this information more accessible and help them evaluate, help them participate.
How do you want to make it happen? Because I know that I didn't pay for the search. Patients don't pay for the search. But I mean, to have that team, well, you need funds. So how do you want to make it happen? How do you want to bring it to more patients and to bring like even more powerful tech to it?
Yeah, one big piece would be investment, of course. If digital health rebounds, investment would be hugely helpful for the technology, for amplifying our presence. I mean, even thank you for this podcast today. This is a great way to amplify what we do as well. We work also with a lot of patient advocacy groups. So we look for the smaller community ones that are trying to educate their community, help give them tools. And so that's a way to reach patients. And on the financial side, we're asking pharma to help compensate us for the patients that ask to be connected and that we bring over. And then for hospitals, we're also exploring now ways to support their staff. So I think now it's been some time after the pandemic and things are back-ish in a hospital setting. And so trials are, again, very interesting, especially in oncology. If you think of, I want to offer my patients really the best options or all the options, you need to have trials at your hospital. So those are other places that we're exploring. We've got a lot of great conversations in the US and in Europe. And we'll actually be publishing our abstract soon of a pilot in the UK where we demonstrated how a tool like ours can just help oncologists and nurses think about trials more often for patients and do that with the same staff and without burdening them as well.
Could you tell a bit more about that study?
Yeah, I can't disclose everything because it's not published yet, but we basically looked at a time period and we said, okay, for the breast department only, how many patients were they able to think about for trials without our tool? And then we did that exercise. Okay, with that time period, some nurses then had our tool and we had this comparator arm. And so without the tool, I think it was 5 patients that they had thought of for studies. And with our tool, we found 53.
Okay.
And we found for those patients trials at that hospital, but also in partner hospitals, so hospitals nearby. And kind of the reaction was, you know, wow, we didn't know that many patients would have been eligible for some of these studies. And also, we never really had the time and the staff to be able to consider trials outside our hospital as well.
Because what it means, I mean, you don't have to really start looking for a trial when you run out of any other options, right? Because there are trials also for patients who start the treatment.
Oh, exactly. And I think that was a really powerful pilot and case study to help demonstrate how technology can support a lot of these workflows. And I really like John Nasta in this space, who had put it as the relationship between doctor and technology should be kind of, what did the computer say, but what did the doctor do? And so that's where I think tech's role is in curating this information, helping support. So that way, kind of these experts, oncologists and nurses can help make more informed decisions or have the latest data at their fingertips. And it's becoming not humanly possible to do that without technology, just again, because of the pace of innovation, how many new therapies are coming out, how fast we're learning about cancer and how fast that's evolving.
You know, I have this question. I ask them, a lot of startup founders, you know, but what do you consider successful on Ankara and AI?
My dream would be that if we're really successful, then no patient ever has to use our tool, that we've been able to put it into healthcare systems. We've embedded it. It's a quiet tech. No one even knows it exists. And it's just pop-ups or emails to physicians and nurses, letting them know, here are the 10 trials available for this patient. And that's done anywhere, because we've done decentralized trials so people can participate with their local oncologist. And we really open up access to trials to so many people and their families and make it just so easy to do so.
What's next for Ankara?
So our next big project is to put nuclear medicine into our tools. So nuclear medicine is a really exciting therapeutic area especially so in oncology. And we're looking at how to better organize that data, because it's also very, very difficult to find in clinicaltrials.gov. It's had a recent resurgence. It's had a lot of kind of good data coming back as well. And so we'll be adding to our platform an easier way to search through nuclear medicine trials.
What's that? What's that? Yeah. Could you just say?
Yeah, it's how to summarize this. basically taking advantage of nuclear to target cancer cells very effectively and destroy cancer quite quickly. And it works usually as an injection. It can also be used for diagnostic, but with an injection, and usually within 24, 48 hours, you can already see cancer cells dying. But it's much more targeted, which means less toxicity to the body usually. It is, though, early days. It's very difficult. If you think nuclear, there's nuclear waste handling. Also, radioisotopes have lives, and how do we transport this? So there's a lot of kind of infrastructure discussions happening in parallel with the development of nuclear medicine, but it's had really amazing breakthroughs for some difficult cancers. And the application goes even beyond cancer, but it's very difficult or a lot of physicians don't know about it, patients even less so. And so we really need to make those trials also accessible or easier to navigate. And some of the perspectives of adding that technology has also been for doctors to see what's being investigated and what can I bring to my hospital, because I think my patients can benefit from this. And so with that, Josh Mailman, again, has been an amazing advocate. And so we've had some nice organizations that are really prominent in the space offering to work with us, because, again, we need scientific experts. We can't be scientific experts of everything. So they'll help us build that out and then deploy it for both physicians and patients.
And how do you imagine looking for nuclear medicine on your platform? So you need to know that you're looking for nuclear medicine, or would it be included in like the search for, say, ovarian cancer or like solid tumor? Or
yeah, exactly. It would be on the patient side. We try to keep it in that conversational manner of more of this questionnaire based system, where we could call it out and just say, are you interested in nuclear medicine trials, or can we flag these for you? But also in the treatment filter section, we also have nuclear medicine there, and we'll extend that as we work on it. And then for the physician version, they'll have a more exploratory interface where they can just say, I'm looking at what's going on in nuclear medicine for this type of cancer, for neuroendocrine tumors as an example. And then they can see all of the trials that are available.
Danielle, so thank you very much for this comprehensive journey into like how to find the trial, you know, all the challenges that you shared and like all the efforts that you put into overcoming them. You know, I wish you strong partners to really, you know, that you have this power to basically overcome these challenges and help more patients basically to find a relevant clinical trial for them. And for you guys listening, if you want to, you know, check the platform, it's ancora.ai, which is ancora.ai.
Thank you so much.
I'm totally impressed by the audacity of researchers turned startup founders, doctors turned entrepreneurs, or ordinary parents turned healthcare innovators. People battling the battles that no one fought before for the extra health of the future. So if you see a startup posting on LinkedIn, show them some love, hit like, comment, that's fabulous. If you have a couple drops more of that altruism, follow the Exhale Show. Leave a review here. I'll be able to bring more of these visionaries to you. So a big thank you. You're awesome. See you next week.
The information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. If you have any medical questions, please consult your healthcare practitioner. The opinions on the show are Alex's or her guests. The podcast does not make any responsibility or warranties about guest statements or credibility. While the podcast makes every effort to ensure that the information shared is accurate, please let us know if you have any comments, suggestions, or corrections.